Please be seated. The last case on today's en banc conference, or oral argument, excuse me, is Elliot A. Alper, trustee of the Elliot A. Alper Revocable Trust et al. Versus District Court. Mr. William Cleese is the real party in interest, case number 64260. Mr. Hannigan, you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. Edward Hannigan for the petitioner. If it may please the court. The issue before the court today is a very simple one. Did the district court exceed its jurisdiction, its authority, when it imposed civil contempt sanctions against Mr. Police rather than the criminal contempt sanctions that the bankruptcy court had modified the automatic stay in the bankruptcy code to allow us to seek? Our position obviously is that the court did. And the facts of the case are outlined in our petition and set forth also in the motion for order to show cause for the district court. But very briefly, just to summarize, my clients have a judgment in excess of $16 million against Mr. Police. Upon receiving the judgment, we begin attempts to collect on the judgment. One of those procedures was a judgment debtor exam pursuant to the NRS. Mr. Police didn't show up at the exam. We tried other times to have him come in. He didn't show up. There were several hearings in front of the district court on contempt. The court threatened Mr. Police with jail time if he didn't show up and cooperate. He eventually showed up and took the Fifth Amendment to every question I asked him, including what his name was. This went on for a period of a couple of years. He would come up with an excuse why he couldn't show up for the hearing. The record shows that some of his excuses were just made up. He says, why was a car accident in Texas? And no, he couldn't come to the hearing yet. He eventually gives us documentation showing that, yes, it was an accident, but it was here in Las Vegas. So it was obvious he was not going to cooperate. 2 days before one of the order to show cause hearings on contempt, Mr. Police files bankruptcy, apparently thinking, okay, I'm done with the state court now. We'll be in bankruptcy court. I took the motion off calendar because I didn't want to violate the automatic stay. 11 U.S.C. Section 362 prohibits most actions against a debtor once they file bankruptcy. So we let the bankruptcy process play out for about a year. The trustee in bankruptcy was very aggressive in going after Mr. Police. He didn't cooperate in the bankruptcy proceedings either. The bankruptcy judge held him in contempt of court for failure to produce documents, to appear at exams. So after about a year, at the prompting of the bankruptcy trustee, we renewed our motion for contempt in state court. Before doing that, we went to the bankruptcy court to modify the stay because we didn't want to be in contempt of the bankruptcy court. The bankruptcy judge, Judge Regal, said, all right, you can go in front of the state court, but only for criminal contempt sanctions. You can't go in to have your client reimbursed for any expenses he's incurred in this process. We brought the motion in front of district court. The judge rightly found Mr. Police in contempt of court and rightly sentenced him to 21 days in the Clark County Detention Center. That's an appropriate criminal contempt sanction. If the judge had stopped there, we wouldn't be here. The judge went on to say, but if you consent to a debtor exam anytime, you can be released from jail. That turned what was a criminal sanction into a civil sanction. And this court has several cases which discuss the distinction, and I think the Warner case probably states it best, that contempt is neither civil nor criminal, it's sui generis. It has attributes of criminal sanctions and civil. So what you look at really is, what did the court do? If the court imposed a sanction for remedial or coercive purposes, that's civil contempt. You're going to go to jail unless you do this, civil. You can get out of jail if you do this, civil. If it's to vindicate the authority of the court, to impose the authority of the court, then it's criminal. You didn't listen to what I ordered you to do. I warned you. You continue to disobey my orders. You're going to jail. That's criminal contempt. That's what the bankruptcy court contemplated the district court allowing. The district court judge just went a little too far and turned his criminal contempt sanction into a civil contempt sanction. And what we're asking this court to do is to issue its writ of prohibition that did not enforce the provision of its order allowing Mr. Police to get out of jail by submitting to a debtor exam.
What was your comment to the judge when he imposed that particular sanction with the ability to purge? Did you make the argument down below?
There's not a transcript. I don't want to misrepresent exactly what went on. I mean, a whole hearing, all the pleadings were here for criminal contempt. It was the judge's ruling. We're going to go on to our next remedy. So
you contested or you didn't? And it's very difficult for us to review without a transcript, of course.
Respondent makes the argument that we didn't say I object. I did not say I object. I mean, well, this is not someone trying to get evidence in.
There was a problem in the district court with the order that the district court entered. That would, by objecting, you would have the opportunity to give that district court judge a chance to correct an error if it was in fact made.
I think it was, our argument was, we're here on a criminal to condemn, not civil contempt. And it did not go any further than that.
Okay. Thank you.
And counsel, to the extent that this question may appear to be an absurdly oversimplification, an absurd oversimplification of the issue, can you tell me why it matters at this point? I mean, isn't the ultimate goal to get Mr. Police in a position where you can take information from him and hopefully allow your client to recover on some of this judgment that is against him? I mean, I know as a matter of legal interpretation it makes a difference. I'm not minimizing that. But in the big picture, why does it matter?
We don't think we're ever going to get Mr. Police to cooperate. The bankruptcy trustee has been very aggressive, and what she has discovered is that what Mr. Police eventually did tell us wasn't true. He has hidden assets. The only reason it does matter is, what good are court orders if people don't have to obey them? And that's really why it matters. It's not going to put another dime in my client's pocket, except if Mr. Police, maybe it dawns on him someday, gee, there are consequences to my actions. Maybe I better pay attention to what a court does. He's been very good. This has been going on for, our judgment was 2010. We filed the lawsuit 2 years prior to that. He's been very adept at delaying, avoiding, evading, and he may very well get away with it.
And the debtor's exam that would have provided the basis for purging the contempt in this case hasn't taken place, has it?
It has not.
So your concern would be, I suppose, that if we initiated the debtor's exam, taken in an effort to purge the complaint, then Mr. Police would argue that the court's order is civil in nature and exceeds the scope of the bankruptcy court's authorized remand.
Yes. Yes. And
so until that issue is resolved, whether it's criminal or not, you may run that risk in taking the debtor's exam.
May run the risk in the debtor's exam. Or he may say, I'll do a debtor's exam and treat it like he's treated the other ones. And the bankruptcy court really, I mean, the trustee has nationwide subpoena power, and she has gone down to Texas, taken exams, has a lot more power than we do sitting, you know, with a state court judgment. And that's why we're kind of relying upon the bankruptcy process to ferret out these assets. And they have found assets, not to the extent that, you know, we believe are out there. So we don't really think the debtor exam is going to really do any good. I don't think Mr. Police is going to see the light of day and, you know, come clean. So I think the only reason we're really here is vindicate the authority of the court.
Could you answer a question that puzzles me, and that is 22110 that talks, it's entitled imprisonment until performance if contempt is omission to perform an act. In these statutes of ours, this one says when the contempt consists in the omission to perform an act which is yet within the power of the person to perform, the person may be imprisoned, which is a criminal sort of word, until the person performs it. The required act must be specified in the warrant of contempt or of commitment. Why doesn't that apply to what this judge did, and why is that so problematic under the federal bankruptcy statutes? I don't see that discussed in the papers. Maybe it was, and I just missed it.
That chapter gives various remedies for contempt. And this court's case law discusses various remedies for contempt.
Right.
And that is more of the civil contempt. That is the coercive remedy.
Sure, but it's certainly not labeled civil contempt, and it's not using that vernacular.
And none of the statutes do. I mean,
I know. So we've got old statutes that are unclear here, but you want us to issue a writ of prohibition, which is an extraordinary writ. We don't have a transcript. I don't know exactly what was argued in the district court, and in particular how this statute may have been distinguished or acquiesced in. That's troubling to me. I think it's along the lines of what Justice Paragari was asking.
My recollection is that was not discussed at the district court. And I think the root of this is NRS 21.270, and that's the judgment debtor statute. And subpart 3 states, a judgment debtor who is regularly served with an order issued pursuant to this section and who fails to appear at the time and place specified in the order may be punished for contempt by the judge issuing the order. So that is a contempt sanction within the judgment debtor statute. And we've got chapter 22, which is a whole chapter on contempt. And then there is a whole statute for actual criminal contempt, which would be brought by the state against somebody.
Right, but we have this thicket of statutes, and they're written on top of each other over time. It's sort of a palimpsest of statutes, if you will. But for me to come in on a prohibition writ, you would want to see what happened in the district court, and it's just not clear to me.
It's factually, there were no witnesses at the district court. Everything was submitted.
But what was the argument? What did you say in the district court that you now want us to enforce?
What we said to the district court is essentially what I said here today,
okay,
that the bankruptcy court has allowed us to come in on a criminal contempt sanctions. That is not to coerce. That is to punish. And I laid out the litany of facts.
That's not in the record, though, right?
It's in the papers filed on our motion for original cause for contempt. But, correct, there's no transcript of that. But that was the argument. Essentially, Judge, here's what happened. This is what we'd like for you to do.
Right. I appreciate your frustration with the process, but I'm just...
No, and it's going through all the various statutes in the laws on contempt. It is murky, and reading the case law, the appellate courts have wrestled with, well, what is contempt, and what do we do, and what's the powers? And quite frankly, when this was set to oral argument, I was thinking, well, maybe we're going to get this cleared up here. What is the authority of a court, and how do we distinguish this?
Mr. Hannigan, I know in reading this, I was kind of interested. I used to do this as an attorney. I probably did dozens and dozens of judgment debtor examinations, and I know you can do it under NRCP 69A or 21.270, but usually the orders was said if you serve the debtor, if the debtor fails to appear, a bench warrant's issued for the debtor's arrest, that you get a bench warrant prepared, signed by the judge, it's given to the sheriff, and if they pick them up, they go to jail, and then they bring them into court, and then you do the judgment debtor exam. I know you had this intervention of the bankruptcy court and the way this is being done, but I'm kind of perplexed with this procedural steps you've had to go through. It seems like it'd be a pretty simple process to get this done, but can you help us out any more on that? I'm trying to comprehend, you know, what's taken years and years to go through this.
Several motions for order to show cause why Mr. Police should not be held in contempt of court. And when we went in front of the district court judges, they would tell his counsel, because he didn't come, he's going to go to jail if he doesn't show up. And then he shows up, he takes the fifth to everything. Or he doesn't bring the documents. And so we were going through this process to get the order to hold him in contempt of court. Now, the original orders for the judgment debtor exam says, if you don't show up, you will be held in contempt of court. But we had to go to that step in front of the court to actually get an order holding him in contempt of court. Unfortunately, the courts were, I think, leaning over backwards, giving him the second chance. And we have had several, you know, judges hearing this as, you know, they left the bench. I mean, I think originally we started out with Judge Hardcastle, then we had Judge Glass, and this particular motion was a visiting judge. So we don't have, you know, that continuity of judges who remember, oh yeah, this has been going on a while now, I better finally put this guy in jail. And at this particular hearing, Mr. Police did show up, and he was handcuffed, and he was processed at the Clark County Detention Center. So he finally got to that point where he was in the system. Now, one of the other issues we brought up in here, but it's now moot, was the judge also said, if you post a $5,000 bail, you can be out pending appeal. Well, of course, you can't appeal a contempt order, and so that was dismissed by this court. So I'm not arguing that today, because I think that issue is moot.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Crone.
Good afternoon, members of the court. When I got the notice that the court had set this for oral argument, and later I noticed it was set for oral argument in Bonk, I was a little surprised. I just looked at this as a rather routine case, and here I am before all seven justices. So I tried to think, well, what is it about this case that dictated you to schedule an oral argument in front of all seven justices? And I think, like Mr. Hannigan, that contempt is an enigmatic legal concept. Is it civil or is it criminal? And Mr. Hannigan is, I don't want to say schizophrenic, but in the federal court, he says, well, this is criminal contempt. In front of this court, he says, well, no, this is civil matter. And the reason he says that is because I've pointed out, look, if it's a criminal matter, it's a misdemeanor. It's a misdemeanor as a misdemeanor is defined in the NRS. It's punishable by less than 6 months in jail. It carries a fine of $500. It's a misdemeanor. And if it's a misdemeanor, the statute of limitations for a misdemeanor applies, and that's 1 year. And if it's 1 year, he's out. So that's why I think this is interesting. And so,
Mr. Crimmin, 1 year from when?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
1 year from when?
From when the contemptuous conduct allegedly occurred.
Well, wouldn't that necessarily make it a conditional sanction?
Well, you know, that's just it.
You've got limits as to what type of contempt as a judge you can impose.
Well,
and, you know, 25 days and...
That's correct. Okay, so I'm a little confused by the concept that just because a punishment is conditional, that renders it civil. Conditional punishment is rampant in the criminal law. You get arrested for a minor drug offense, you go to drug court. We won't punish you. You get arrested for grand larceny, you'll be able to agree to go to petty larceny school, we'll reduce it to a misdemeanor and give you credit for time served. This happened, you get convicted of a felony. You are told, well, you know, we're going to put you on probation, good conduct, you won't have to go to prison. So the idea that punishment is conditional makes it civil is outside of my line of thinking. I don't get it. The fact of the matter is that if you look at criminal contempt as civil based upon the punishment that is imposed, what is the defense or the accused supposed to think right up until the time that punishment is imposed? Is it civil? Well, I don't know. Is it criminal? I don't know. I'll only find out when the judge chooses to punish me. Hey, that's putting the cart before the horse. Something has to pull the wagon. And here, to say, well, the punishment is conditional and therefore it's civil, doesn't make any sense. It's not logical. We make distinctions in the criminal law about the severity of crime. I've written that you've determined, or you've used the phrase civil contempt, based upon the rights that are to be accorded a man accused or a woman accused.
Well, if it's a misdemeanor under Augustine and you're going to face a jail sentence, you're entitled to a counsel.
That's limited. Court appointed, if you're an indigent, yes. But, you know, for the same thing, you've determined for domestic violence and DUI, misdemeanors, that you're not entitled to a jury trial. In a contempt proceeding, are you entitled to proof beyond a reasonable doubt? What's the answer? Oh, we'll determine that after I've made the decision as to what the punishment's to be.
But Mr. Krimen, under your analysis, we won't even get to this because the statute of limitations is taken off.
I mean, it's done. But if you want to look at it on all of its merits, there's nothing in the NRS that tells a justice or a judge who's got a contempt proceeding on him that he can only impose certain punishments. There's nothing there. The legislature's prescribed the punishments that he can impose, and this was one of those punishments that Judge McGee, the visiting judge, had the authority to impose.
Tell me a little bit more about the order from the bankruptcy court.
The
bankruptcy court essentially directed that the district court impose a criminal sanction.
Well, that's just that. Does the bankruptcy judge determine the nature of the contempt? Does she say, well, this is criminal contempt, and Judge McGee or whoever's going to hear this in the state court, you can only oppose a civil remedy. That's a criminal remedy. That's what they're saying. Well, look, the reason criminal proceedings are not stayed by bankruptcy code, and that's 11 U.S.C. 362 subsection B1. And that's the reason the bankruptcy judge kicked it out. It's a criminal matter. And therefore, it's not subject to the stay. The federal bankruptcy court couldn't say, and by the way, whoever hears this has to throw this man in jail.
That's essentially what they're saying.
That is what they're saying. And there's no authority for that. The bankruptcy court let this thing go because she had to. It was a criminal proceeding, and it was so identified by Mr. Hannigan in his pleadings with the federal court. It is so identified by Mr. Hannigan in his proceedings in this court. Look at his petition, page 11, or I'm sorry, 12 of his petition before this court. So, well, what do we do in contempt proceedings? Do we say, okay, put the case on, and I'll make a decision, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, as to what the contempt is, and retroactively I'll determine whether or not that's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, or is it the preponderance of the evidence. I'll determine retroactively whether he was really needed an attorney or not. I'll determine retroactively whether he needed counsel or not. Those are rights privileges that someone should have when the proceedings are commenced. He ought to know. Well, what am I looking at? Should I get an attorney? Do I need an attorney? Is it proof beyond a reasonable doubt? What is it? Did I only know after the punishment's imposed? I don't think so. That's not the way the system should work. So you have an opportunity, I think, in this case, given these facts, to do the state, maybe the nation, a favor as to what is criminal contempt, what is the nature of the proceedings.
Did you make these arguments in the district court, and if so, where are they in the record?
I made the argument to the district court, A, that my client's conduct was not contemptuous, and B, that it was a criminal matter for which the statute of limitations had run.
Right.
Okay, that's what I said. That was it. My client was then, as Mr. Henning was, as I point out, Judge McGee entered his order, and he was handcuffed. He was taken across the street. He was photographed. He was fingerprinted.
Run a writ on that?
No, I did not. I had thought at the time that this was an appealable order. And there was a little confusion. You straightened that out, and I've recognized that. Now, that's another matter. Misdemeanors are subject to an appeal. Contempt is not. But that's not unusual. Different crimes can be treated differently, and you've done so in any number of circumstances with regard to jury trials and so forth.
What's the statute that allows the district court to hear a misdemeanor?
What's the statute that allows a district court to hear a misdemeanor?
No, to hear a misdemeanor.
I think the NRS Chapter 22 gives him that authority when he's dealing with contemptuous conduct.
So the appeal could come to us, not necessarily to the district court like most misdemeanor appeals do. We don't do misdemeanor appeals rarely.
The district court does misdemeanor appeals.
Right.
Yeah, but
you
determine contempt proceedings are not appealable. And, you know, I recognize that.
How many days did he do?
He was in custody for about 3 hours and then was released. He's just waiting on pins and needles to know.
How'd you get him out?
We did file. Judge McGee said, well, is contempt appealable? And I said, well, of course it is. I cited the cases that I had cited to him in my brief, which were appeals from contempt proceedings. Prior to that proceeding, you had decided that a contempt order was not appealable, but I'll be the first to admit I was not cognizant of that. So he posted bail and he was released.
Right. Mr. Kramer, I just want to pose this to you, and maybe this is why this is en banc, we have to define this, but my concept is that criminal contempt may be something where a defendant like mouths off to the judge in the judge's presence in courtroom, and the judge summarily says 20 days or whatever. I saw that a lot, you know, as an attorney sitting in the audience at trials, where the civil contempt is like violation of an injunction, a court order, and the punishment there is coercive, that you can order somebody arrested and held in jail until they comply with the order or the injunction here. And so it's really a civil type proceeding as opposed to a criminal proceeding.
You know,
what's your thoughts on that?
If you look at 193.120, that's the legislation that establishes the statute of limitations on criminal offenses. And what it says in the very first paragraph is this: a crime is an act of omission forbidden by law and punishable by conviction, by death, imprisonment, fine, or other penal discipline. So there's crime, and then there's criminal proceeds. There is another statute, the section of the NRS 169.095, that talks about what a criminal action is. And that's a means proceedings by which a party charged with a public offense is accused and brought to trial and punishment. A criminal action is prosecuted in the name of the state of Nevada as plaintiff. So there's crimes and there's criminal proceedings. I would be first to admit that in your example, in a civil proceeding, the vehicle is a civil proceeding, but the punishment is for an act that is defined as a crime in NRS 193.120. So I think you have to make that distinction. And if you do, all this is consistent. There is one other case, and I didn't cite it. It's an old case from 1883 in Ray Sweeney. And in Ray Sweeney, you had an incident like you've described. You had a mandatory injunction which required the parties to the proceeding to allow them to draw so much water. And one of the parties to the proceeding was accused of drawing more than his allotment. And so there was a proceeding for him to be held in contempt. And he was ordered, held in contempt, and he was given a punishment of 5 days or $500. And he appealed. He appealed because he didn't have $500. So the court said, okay, you're going to do 250 days in jail. Because under what they call the Criminal Proceedings Act that was in existence at that time, a jail sentence or a fine could be served or paid by day, by 2 days, $2 for each day in jail. So on appeal, the court said, well, look, you know, we have to look at this. Contempt is like a criminal charge. We have to read these statutes strictly. But because it's of the nature of a criminal charge, we are going to follow the Criminal Procedure Act, and the sentence is appropriate. You know, I don't know what its value is, but it's there. And it addresses, I think, the issue that you raised. So all I'm saying is take the opportunity to do everybody a favor.
What's happening in bankruptcy court right now? Anything?
I don't represent them there. It's a little out of my line. But it's my understanding that the bankruptcy trustee approached the U.S. attorney to bring criminal proceedings. I can give you a little bit of information. It's not part of the record, but if you want to know.
No, I don't think you can then.
Okay. All right.
I have a question, though.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there anything in the record that suggests that petitioner is being punished because the district court in this case strayed beyond the bounds of criminal contempt and went into civil? In other words, did they violate the stay? Is that an accusation that's been made to them and there's some sort of procedure?
No,
Okay, so
now, the bankruptcy court did kick it back. I don't think it had to be kicked back because I think these were criminal proceedings, as Mr. Anning and I identified, and the district court.
And your client has no longer any right of review on these issues, on the contempt issue.
No.
Right.
Okay. If there's anything else, I'll sit down and take them. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Appreciate it. And thank you, Mr. Hannigan, for your arguments today. I think the court understands the case, and it will stand submitted.